Mark Presidis, the director of the Creative Writing Program here at WVU. On behalf of the Department of English and our chair, John Ernest, and associate chair, Timothy Sweet, and Laura Brady. Are you out there, Laura? I was going to compare you to Meryl Streep, but you win the Oscar for us every year, so. And my colleagues in creative writing, Kevin Oderman, Marianne Salmon, Ethel Morgan Smith, Alyssa High, Glenn Taylor, and the man not only of the hour, but of many days, months, and years of visionary leadership of the creative writing program here, as well as, of course, wonderful poetry, Jim Harms. Welcome, and thank you all for coming. I have the pleasure of introducing the introducer tonight, which makes me the introducer once removed. And in that role, I will say this. My sister, bless her, calls creative writers the rock stars of the Academy. So you'll have to decide tonight which rocker Jim most resembles. But if you notice someone holding up a lighter and yelling for the Bob Marley poem, that will be me. Our introducer tonight is my colleague and the dynamic poet and professor, Marianne Salmon.
Hi there, can you hear me? This is so far away. That's how you, from your people? Okay. I gotcha. Okay. Anyway, welcome to an evening at which we celebrate all of Jim's poetry, but especially these two new books, Comet Scar, out from Carnegie Mellon, a fan in the first room, and What to Borrow, What to Steal, just out from Merrick Press. To have two books out in a year is remarkable. To have them out like within a week is a little much. Now, the convention when giving introductions is to say it's my pleasure to introduce so-and-so, but if you're like me, you sometimes wonder, really? This time, too? So first, to assure you, yes, it really is my pleasure to introduce Jim and say a few words about his poems. Normally, I beg off doing intros. I don't like to do them. I think they're embarrassing to give and to receive, and we were talking about that today, because I always have that little doubt of, really? This time, too? But this time, I asked to give the introduction because my admiration for Jim's poems is sincere, and the relationship that we have, actual friendship, and not mere collegiality, is also real, and perhaps more unusual among poets than you might imagine. Yes, truly. Especially ones at the same school. That's the thing. Among the many things we can offer our students, Jim and I, especially at the grad level, is the genuineness of that relationship and our shared sense of what poems are good for and, indeed, what they need to do in order to be poetry. That is, we agree about the heart of poetry, its essential heartfeltness. A few weeks ago, I sent Jim a poem that appeared on Poetry Daily, a website that boasts a new poem every day, and that I'm sure is familiar to many of you. I said, here's another terrible poem. Why write this? He agreed, of course. The poem was over before it had begun. The title was plenty. The rest, a mere working out of an initial clever-ish idea. All of which is to say that when I read a poem by Jim, I do not question why it was written. I do not wonder, so what? I stand back, not in frustration or dismay, but in consideration of Jim's considerations, the moments he has held up to the light so that he and we might see. Moreover, Jim's poems are full of heart, which means, of course, that they remind us that poetry is not for the faint of heart. The questions in real poems are themselves too real, too without clear answers, to offer easy consolation to those for whom everything must be reassuringly and simultaneously clevered up and dumbed down. Jim's poems are also not over before they have begun. Indeed, they linger long after they have been read, their power like that of the crescent moon he describes in one of them, which we cannot touch, but which also, look down now, is the scar on the face of the one we love. Or like that middle distance Jim often points to, where memory and dreams coexist and waver like heat, luminously present and just out of reach. Last night in the grad workshop and today in my undergrad class, I talked about Jim's work. Do you see what he does? I said, do you see how he does it? Do you have any idea how hard it is to tell the story of thinking and feeling in a way that looks easy. There's no need to complexify life as so many poets would have us believe. Complexity is readily there. True poems illuminate it, quite simply. Jim's elegant poems are among those true ones, illuminating our little city along the river where we spend our days or save them, singing our almost private songs of consolation or company, drifting to love or sleep. Please welcome Jim Harms.
Wow, that was the best introduction I've ever had. Thank you so much. Thank you also for being here tonight. I really appreciate it. It's great also to see, I mean, not just so many of my students, though I adore you, but I've been working with some of your professors for 10 and 20 years, and to see them here tonight, I mean, I really can't tell you how important that is to me. We've been through a lot together. We're going to be through a lot more together, and we always have each other's back, and that's a good feeling. And as Marianne suggested, it's not all that common in academia to have this kind of collegiality and warmth, so I'm really grateful for it. And thank you, John, for your leadership. All right, so I'm just going to... This mic sounds really tinny to me. Are you guys okay with it?
I not only have your back, I've got... Oh, you've got your water.
Oh, I might drink three. This poem is called "The Day My Eyes Came Back." It's a brand new book, so I can't find any of the poems. There are three songs in her hand. The orange tastes like a hoof print. First days are velvet slippers in the trees, all these worms in an old soup can, river of solder, river of twine. The river holds the earth in place as it spins loose its loose leaves. I'm tired of budding into air too clear to swallow. The day my eyes came back, she walked through the door like a blue shout in the silver dusk. I still got your venom in my mouth. She held my kiss beneath her tongue, touched my neck, found the cobweb in my voice and brushed it loose. Don't bruise your knees, the one song goes, please. So there are many ways to communicate, right? So before text messaging, I just hate doing it. I hate sounding like an old fart. But when we were kids, and the snow was to our hips in Los Angeles, and we walked to school, one of the ways that we communicated, and this is an old-fashioned thing you might even find in Huck Finn, was to tie two cans together with string. See, don't do that anymore. Maybe my 12-year-old has a cell phone. But anyways, it worked for us. So this poem is about ways of communicating. It's a love poem. It's in four sections, and it's called "Or Two Cans Tied Together with String." One, my wife sings like laughing water in a pot, peels onions for a stew that will, by evening's end, simmer with the old earth smells of lamb and rosemary, potatoes and saffron. All other scents, just quiet clamoring, the steam leaking out the open window above the sink, where minutes ago she gathered in the bird and kissed the gray down of its neck before tugging loose the note, before returning it to the air. Two. I fell asleep mid-afternoon and woke to bells and the dusty tin notes of an antique piano, flurries aging the early evening. I made a sandwich of mustard and cheese, stood at the window watching the music blow with snow in the backyard, wrapped a Chinese fortune around my last pigeon's rickety left leg, and climbed the rope ladder to the roof to let it go. Three.
Once I hid a love note in her sock drawer and waited months until she found it. By then, nothing had changed. Which is a way of saying love is a glacier devouring the daisies in a mountain meadow. They disappear so slowly, we forget to remember the beauty. 4. I slid the cold pigeon inside my shirt before returning it to the cage. My wife was singing Ruby May, the window still cracked enough to let out the song with all that steam, the sounds beneath the smells, how a voice changes over time and distance, or it doesn't. I had to take a drink because, you know, I was thinking when I was in my 20s, God, I'm just going to reminisce tonight. And I'd go to poetry readings and I'd watch the poets sip from their little cups. What I always noticed is that as the reading went on, the poet got funnier and more garrulous. And when the cup was empty, they began to look around furtively. And then the reading was over. So, thankfully, none of that goes on anymore, and I can assure you it's not tonight, but you're welcome to drink my water afterwards. This is a poem called My Life in Art. I had to drink a sip of water on it before because it's, you know, it's about as erotic as I get in my poems. Jeez. To dig so deep so early in the evening. I think the only reference you might need to know is that Etta Place is a woman. She was the Sundance Kid's significant other. And in the movie, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Etta Place was played by Catherine Ross, which is probably worth explaining nowadays. My life's in art. She felt the edges of the moment like the smooth face of a dime. I felt her face with my eyes closed against the sparks, the spray around her fingers as she opened an orange. She guessed about my money. She showed me the buttons on the inside. For hours, the rain thickened into snow, then back again. She said, okay, enough. Just talk about your brother, the last good wave you caught before leaving, but don't do that. But she let me. The clasp is what I'd call it, a hook, she said, and I had it in my teeth as she lit a cigarette and said, it's snow now for good. We heard the same small voice become a crocus in the earth beside the car in a cough descending the staircase. You can't afford this, she said, or that. I showed her my fake eye, my blonde marble, my wallet photo of Catherine Ross is at a place. She sang instead of anything, though she held me a while, or part of me. And when I floated away, I left a gift in her hand, a little pearl. In thinking about this reading tonight, I was going through this particular book, Comet Scar. And for the first time, and one would think it would not have been the first time, I realized that there are 3 references to the Odyssey in this book, which seems excessive. I'm not sure anybody would notice this, so I'm just alerting you to the fact that this makes reference to the Odyssey and to Leda and the Swan, etc. But it's actually set in Morgantown, and it's called Friday Rich, Saturday Poor. The swans follow Helen, a sandwich in her pocket, and now she's screaming at her boyfriend, thank you for making me beg, as he rides away on his Schwinn, waving one finger. Beneath the bridge, the smell of batteries and goose shit, the smell of old wool all wet with fog and breath, the smell of Friday night, the smell of clear air beaten blue by spray paint and rotten fruit. Even Hector has a check to cash, and we're all wondering where to go first, the liquor store on Beechhurst or the sub shop near the bus station. I wish Helen's phone would stop ringing. I never understand the Rivertown girls with their frayed sleeves and pearls like broken teeth around their necks, at their wrists. If we hurry, we can spend every dollar by dawn. The smell of iron, or the taste of it. The look of Helen, all stoned and happy in a gas lamp's cold glow. The look of beer in a glass, the look of polished wood, the ring stains and puddles, the letters carved with a penknife. Friday is a kiss. I don't get the steam on the river. I wish the moon would stop shaking. I wish Saturday would stay still on the other side of midnight. There's a little girl, or Helen, staring at a shop window, waiting for the mannequin to move. This is the first of several sonnets I'm going to read tonight that have extra lines. That's called cheating. I call them sonnet with extra last line. Otherwise, they're perfect sonnets. And it's called bar talk, as in people who talk in bars about things. But this is the first time and the last time I will ever explain this reference, and it can't go beyond this room. It's called Bar Talk, and it's set in the Magnificent Grill in Morgantown, West Virginia. So do you get it? Kids, do you get it? What do you get, Walt?
I think I get it.
What do you get?
Bartok
the Magnificent.
Yeah.
A Disney movie. Which I've seen so many times that I've made a poem called Bartok. I know, I did mean Bartok, but it's the play on words. Okay. And I told the kids on the way over that some of these poems were PG-13, and that's just the way it was. Bar talk. Bits of bullet, the shards and stains, boots full of blood, the walking around on bones, the knife and razor shaving years from each edge of a perfect life. The spent wisdom, the nods and shrugs and woeful giving up on going on. So what? He was right, whoever he was, who rang down the night like a hand clapped to a shoulder, a forearm, a bald fist shivering on a tabletop, the bar, the jukebox full of Jackson Brown, the Eagles, the Dead. He was right. Figuring it all out is the ass end of memory, is why you're here instead of sleeping with her hair half in your mouth, your breath half gone, choking on her and happy to a little death. So now you know what's what, that easy feeling, peaceful. Well, let me introduce you to tomorrow. It's not nearly as happy as the movie. What to Borrow, What to Steal is a fun book for me because it was an opportunity to collect poems that I still liked but that had never fit into any of the previous books. And this, of course, is an indulgence, but a pleasurable one. It's not as though I didn't think these books were up for the, you know, to be included earlier. It's just that for whatever reason, they just didn't fit. They didn't work or something was not quite right. So they go back 20 years. And this poem I'll start with is the oldest book in the oldest poem in the book. And if you ever look at this book, in the very back, it tells you what period of time the poems were composed. So this poem was composed sometime around 1990. It's like older than some of you. And did not go into my first book, Modern Ocean, because I could just never get the timing right. Just never quite felt right. And so about 10 years ago, I put it into prose. And that seemed to help. So, this is 30-year-old Jim. It's a poem called First Ghost, and the title explains it all. It's about, you know, everybody has their first ghost. the first friend who dies. This particular guy and I used to go up to a place in Altadena, California called Gravity Hill. And I think every town has one of these, or every town with hills. You could park on Gravity Hill, and you would appear to be pointed down the hill, but you would go backwards up the hill. There were, I don't know, well, I'm an English professor. I have no idea what happened, but it's really cool if you're in high school. First ghost. You used to phone from a summer job, frightened suddenly that you were in love alone. I listened to you worry about her, describe the things she said or did. All summer I listened, watching out the window as birds fled the trees and returned, and you listed your fears. Here I am accepting those terms again, a quiet caring that doesn't really help. I think I missed somewhere I haven't been in 3 ridiculous years, and going home won't help, but I do. I arrive unannounced in a room full of friends. Ron nods toward the porch door, and you're there on the back patio as if alive again, rolling joints, waiting. We drive up to Gravity Hill, get stoned with a view of the valley, a jewelry box of lights. As always, I don't say much. As always, you tell me everything except what it's like to be gone for good. And when we coast back down the dark mountain, the engine off, sunglasses in place, night and death will rhyme in our minds. You, a poem I'll never need to memorize. And another poem called, this one's just called Ghost, as opposed to First Ghost. It's after Weldon Keyes, who's not as well known as he should be. Somebody called up and said, would you like to contribute a poem to an anthology of poems influenced or inspired by Weldon Keyes? And I said, sure. So I sent off a couple of poems, and they said, well, these aren't inspired by Weldon Keyes, and they sent them back. So I wrote one on the spot and sent that one, and they said, perfect. So anyways, this is another sonnet. I think it has only 14 lines, but I'm not going to count. And it's about a ghost. I mean, it's about wishing that at least the ghost won't leave, since everyone else has. Ghost. The cat won't settle down. From attic to litter box, he's paced the limits of his life since I filled his bowl this morning. And now he's watching the same one spot he's avoided all day, as if a chill has come to rest there beneath the window shaded by holly branches, where usually he drops from the radiator and stops to watch his shadow catch up before strolling on to the kitchen or basement door, open always a crack so he can reach his box. Our cat won't take his eyes off you for fear you'll leave for good. Leave both of us here alone, though he'll have his fear. I hope he shares. Another sonnet. See, I have a policy of only including no more than 2 sonnets in any book. And that's why they're all in this book. These are the leftover sonnets. By October of fall semester, I'm no longer able to write in the normal way I write because it's busy, you know? We're teaching, we're creating papers. And so I just start writing formal poems because it keeps me writing and I don't have to think about, you know, the reasons I normally write, which are generally need. And this one's called Your Big Black Cadillac, after the song. It's the you in the poem is my mother. My sister died this past year, young, at the age of 55. This was written about a year before she died. Your big black Cadillac. Your daughter drove your black Cadillac when she was 12. First down Maiden Lane, then past Miss Samuelson's house, outside of which Miss Samuelson hosed her zinnias, and watched, astonished, as your Cadillac passed by undriven, or so it seemed, her head, your daughter's, so low behind the wheel, she must have guessed her way along. How sad, thought Miss Samuelson, once she realized who was driving. Not how frightening or how scandalous, not even how strange. Already the world was waiting for her, your daughter, to drive into the ocean, to live out her days, dying in slow motion. This book also collects a few longer poems, which one generally doesn't read readings, but Amanda, who's learning Spanish, insisted that I read this one. So I've just, you know, passed off all responsibility to her. And there's really not much Spanish. It's called Buscando America, or America, and it's a poem after the great song and album by Ruben. He's actually Ruben Blades, even though he's Panamanian, because his great-grandfather was English, but he's known more often as Ruben Blades. He's a great Panamanian salsa singer, magnificent. And he also almost president of Panama. He ran for president, got a Harvard Law degree, brilliant guy. So in 1984, he puts out this incredible album called Buscando America, and it's not just a hit all over Latin America. I think it sold 25 million copies. But it's actually a pretty good hit in the United States. And a lot of that has to do with it being 1984. It's, you know, the Reagan administration. And I'm living in Washington, D.C., and I'm terrified. I wake up terrified, I go to bed terrified. And despite what the pundits say about the Reagan administration, many of us lived through it terrified. And that's a little bit what this poem is about. So I quit grad school at George Washington University because it was ridiculous, and got a job delivering for an art gallery. And what I delivered were certificates, because this art gallery couldn't sell a piece of art if it, you know, had every representative in the world. But in the back of the art gallery was a sweatshop. And there were all these women there from 7 in the morning till 5, and they were all women, I was already saying, from 7 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. And what they did was, they were calligraphers, and they just wrote names on certificates. And those certificates went out all over D.C. to various departments and agencies, and I rode my bike. And it was an amazing job, I have to say. And there was never a lack of certificates, if you can imagine, you know, how many public servants there are. So that's the setting. And the woman who ran this sweatshop was a Venezuelan beauty who stood there and just handed out more certificates. I think she was the wife of a diplomat. All right, Buscando America. I've just explained the whole poem. I shouldn't even read it now. In 1984, I knew enough not to look for America. By the way, Buscando America means looking for America. And I should know enough not to make her her woman. But kidnapped and gagged, she was gone. Each morning I walked through Lafayette Park on my way to work, a gallery on M Street, the back room filled with women bent over forms and certificates, calligraphers charged with commemorating America's public servants, 10 years at HUD, 25 at State. I delivered all over town, the Hoover Building or Treasury, a dozen each day to EPA, then out to the Pentagon, where Anthony, every time, waved his wand and a lazy S around my bag and body and laughed. Go ahead, little brother, take your paper gold watches to the sad folk in accounting. When someone disappears, it's usually the teeth the family hopes to find. When America was carried off into the night, she left behind her shadow like a blanket to cover the dead. And we're measuring the femur, and we're testing the ragged fringe for blood, a foot exposed like Florida dangling from her body. Even Castro has forgotten what she looks like, though he sends her his refugees and stowaways, flares testing the depth of sky, a rocket's red glare. While America was gone, we named our national airport for a beloved despot, elected the lesser son of a minor spy, himself a slender pretender, a doorman given the keys. I woke one day with my hands tied behind me, was told to walk to West Virginia without looking back. But I couldn't help it. And when I saw her face, like an empty cage, her voice a thrush flying out in front of her, I knew America had not returned. Though she was close enough to touch, my hands still bound. And she said out loud without speaking, "Why are you still looking for me?" She was not my mother or a lover, not Eurydice returning to Bogota. She was not the wife of a Venezuelan diplomat lining up the orders each morning, 5 certificates to the Russell Building, another 3 to the OEOB. "And here," she said one day, "take this to America," by which she meant the White House, where room after room stood empty, where voices spoke from vacant chairs and silhouettes filled the windows. Estoy buscando America, a vinyl promise becoming a prayer. But when I find her, I'll deliver the last gray certificate, its dates incomplete like the headstone of a widow waiting to die. In 1984, the world was an eyelash from flames, a caught breath from the silence within the blast. And America was missing. Today, we're waiting still. We're holding her robe and listening for the song she always sings, a spiritual without words, though everyone, hat in hand, sings along. I am going to read 3 more poems. The one is really short. Guess which one that is after I read it. All right. Title of this poem is "Though Not About Him or For Him," a poem called Bill Murray. The truth about Groundhog Day has nothing to do with winter. Nothing to do with overcast mornings or the way a shadow softens at the edges like a child's first brush with watercolor. It has nothing to do with courage, since even an eagle will balk and falter when surprised by its own shadow, the clouds cracking just a bit as it drops toward the rabbit, a shaft of light in his shape on the grass, black wings, black talons, what's that? The rabbit down the hole. The truth about Groundhog Day has nothing to do with weeks of winter, with all the weariness of watching the gray of another dawn. A little boy turns to his father and says, "I hope he sees his shadow." And his father says, "I hope not," though he knows they are hoping the same thing, since both of them, this second, are collecting coal for the snowman's eyes and buttons and love these days when everything is closed or canceled. "Does Santa Claus really bring coal for bad children?" says the boy. But that's another poem, a poem called Jimmy Stewart. And here's a poem for that little boy. The other kind of poem I write when I'm not writing and I'm sitting in class and waiting for people to finish a quiz or something like that are acrostics. I mean, why not? Anything to get you to write, right? So usually I just write my kid's name down the page and then see what happens. And this is the only one I've ever published. It's called Walt. Acrostic just means that now every line's going to start with a letter from his name. So the first line starts with W, the second line with A, the third line with L, and the fourth line with T. Walt. "Werewolves do exist," you said firmly one evening. "After all, the full moon is full for a reason. Love limns the leaves or rusts like the slow eroding seasons. Time is like a bite, you said, except it hurts without ending. And the last poem is the title poem, The Comet Scar. There are 10 poems in this book that take their titles from songs by the late, great Grant McLennan, an Australian songwriter and a member of the Go-Betweens, a relatively unknown band in the United States. For some reason, his death really resonated with me and in my life for quite a time, and so I ended up writing these songs. And I think it had something to do with the simplicity and purity of his songs. They're really just pop songs. And I liked the fact that they understood that about themselves and seemed to really know how to work within a form to extraordinary achievement. His song, Cattle and Cane, is considered one that was named one of the 10 great Australian songs of all time. So I mean, that gives you some sense of the significance down under. Anyways, this is a straight-up elegy for Grant McLennan, and it also names a couple of his other songs as well. It's called Comet Scar. For months after his death, Phoebe sings along in the back seat to Comet Scar without a word except the words to the song. Then one day she asks, "What's a comet scar?" And I say, "It's what's left from coming so far. A scar on a girl who knows more than ordinary people ever know." But those are just the lyrics, and she's already heard them, though she doesn't argue. Now she's singing 1 + 1, which doesn't require explanation since 1 + 1 = 2, she says, and she's sure. But 2 1s never add up to anything in the song, which is about love and its aftermath. And someday she'll ask about that. Maybe it will be the day she says, "Who's singing?" And I'll tell her. And as always, she'll follow up with, "Is he alive or dead?" Which she gets from her older brother, who's not happy that Basil Rathbone is no longer with us and checks nearly every day to see if Johnny Depp is still around. Film is tricky that way. So I guess I'll tell her, no, he's not alive. Though instead, perhaps, we'll listen to Finding You, his last AM hit, where he asks, "What would you do if you turned around and saw me beside you, not in a dream, but in a song?" And without looking in the rearview mirror, I'll say, "Can you see him beside you, Phoebs?" And I know she'll say yes, because she believes in all sorts of things she can't see, which is a kind of seeing. And while the song is playing, and maybe longer, we'll both sing along, which is a kind of scene. Thank you very much.